Okay, good evening, everybody. So we're continuing with the Lotus Sutra, and we're going to start with chapter 4. You know, if you think about how studying the sutras is as old as Buddhism itself, in the time of the Buddha, it was live teachings. So we think of them as sutras now. They were recorded and eventually written down, and so now we see them as sutras. But in the time of the Buddha, they were teachings, just live teachings, and that students would remember, memorize, and reflect on, and go over, reflect on again and again. And there are many teachings that are like that, that warrant repeated, or just, I wouldn't even think of it as repeated, but just a kind of an ongoing relationship. That doesn't mean that you're always studying it necessarily, but that at different times you pick it up and you go into it, and then you put it down, put it on your bookshelf, and then you come back to it again. And that studying, you know, how to read a sutra as a meditation, you know, it needs to be careful, slow, really that you're really taking in what you're reading, to stop and reflect. Sometimes it means stopping and going and looking at other sources to try and understand certain terms or what something might mean, coming back to it. And to really let the sort of the effect of the sutra have a chance. By really just taking it into your mind and letting the language. You know, I admit that some of the Mahayana sutras, you know, can go on for a long time just with a guest list, you know, who's there, or descriptions of the worlds. But to, you know, just to really consider these as sacred texts that have come down to us because they're have been important all along the way, and that people that are important to us, whether we know them or not, practitioners, teachers, who study these texts and benefited from them and taught them. And so we, in that sense, are part of that sort of larger lineage. And so to, you know, really sort of think about, be aware of how you engage these teachings, because we all have, you know, a long-standing relationship with a book, words on a page. You know, sometimes we can just get into wanting to, you know, read it and have read it so that we can go on to the next one. And that's just not going to be very helpful. And that, like so many things, you know, with the repeated encounters, it's as though the sutra begins to transform. It seems to become more meaningful or more present or more immediate. But of course, we're the ones that are changing. And there are many things that are like that. I mean, a painting, a piece of music, any field of study in which we encounter it and we have some experience, some understanding. And then we go on and we continue to develop ourselves. And then when we come back to it, we experience it differently. We experience more of it. You know, it's like, how did I not see that in the painting before? How did I not hear those lines, that conversation in that symphony, that quartet? How did I not hear that dialogue, right, in that novel or in that play? So let's start with chapter 4. And I recognize that I'm doing this a little oddly, in that this really significant parable that's really juicy, you know, I said we're not going to really go into it tonight too much because I'm saving it for the ongoing intensive because I want to weave it in. I actually gave a series of talks years ago. Were you in the city at that time? Yeah. Quite a number of talks based on that parable that I thought might wind up in a book. And when I sat down some months later to start looking at those talks and think about it, it was just like, oh, they weren't quite working for me. So another great idea bites the dust. So here, these disciples. Now remember that these disciples that are being quoted here are part of the Buddha's original sangha, you know, the original students. And so they are arhats. They are sort of the seniors of the Buddha's sangha. And so these are really the leaders, you know, along with the Buddha and the next generation, although some of them are quite old and actually died before him. But that is to say, they're very highly regarded beings as being deeply enlightened and have a very prominent place within the Sangha. And so here, they speak as one body and say, we stand at the head of the monks and are all of us old and decrepit. We believe that we had already attained nirvana and that we were incapable of doing more because there was no more to be done. And so we never sought to attain Anuttara Samyak Sambodhi. It's been a long time since the World Honorable One first began to expound the Dharma. And during that time, we have sat on our seats, our bodies weary and inert, meditating solely on the concepts of emptiness, non-form, and non-action. And so remember, this is a Mahayana Sutra that is speaking about these early disciples who represent the early tradition, the non-Mahayana tradition, those not following the Bodhisattva path. Okay, so these words that these disciples are speaking have been given to them by Mahayana. It's a Mahayana voice, basically. So during that time, we were meditating solely on the concepts of emptiness, non-form, and non-action. That is, they've been focusing and really essentially practicing and realizing and coming to enlightenment on the truth of emptiness, of self, of form, of action. But as to the pleasures and transcendental powers of the law of the Bodhisattva, of the path of compassion, of alleviating the suffering of others, or the purifying of a Buddha land and the salvation of living beings, these our minds took no joy in. We weren't drawn to that. We had no attraction to that. That was not something that we were interested in, concerned about. Why? Because the World Honorable One had made it possible for us to transcend the threefold world and to attain the enlightenment of nirvana. So the Buddha had, as their teacher, had enabled them to realize this emptiness, to transcend the world, to attain nirvana, to cut off all afflictions, to realize cessation, and to never return. Right? This is the last life, the last birth. He says, but when we heard the Buddha's teachings, which the Buddha uses to teach and convert the bodhisattvas, our minds were not filled with any thought of joy or approval. But now in the presence of the Buddha, we have heard this voice here. Another, I think it was Subhuti, or was it Shariputra? Shariputra has, in the previous chapter, received a prophecy that he will attain perfect enlightenment. And now their minds are greatly delighted. They've gained what they never had before. Suddenly they have been able to hear this teaching. that they were not able to hear before. And then they go on to say, you know, we'll employ a parable to make clear our meaning, and they go into this rather lengthy, the longest parable in the sutra about, and you've all read it, right? So I don't need to reiterate it. Where this wandering child is, you know, representing the one who has great wealth, but doesn't know that. And so they go wandering across the countryside looking, just wandering, because they have nothing at home to keep them on. They have no wealth to take advantage of, to sort of nourish their life with. And so they go wandering, and they become more and more destitute, and then eventually they come home, and through this long process of gaining faith, gaining trust, the child eventually is able to receive what they could not receive before, is able to recognize their rightful place, their rightful inheritance, which initially, if you remember this story, was not possible, right? In fact, they were so freaked out that they fainted, right? And so at the end of that parable, these disciples come back to sort of comment and say, we were diligent and exerted ourselves in this manner, the same way as this wandering child did, until we had attained nirvana, which is like one day's wages. Right? Not going to satisfy for very long. And once we had attained that, our hearts were filled with great joy, and we considered that this was enough. And once we said to ourselves, because we have been diligent and exerted ourselves with regard to the Buddha Dharma, we have gained this breadth and wealth of understanding. But the world-honored one, knowing from past times how our minds clung to unworthy desires, and we delighted in lesser doctrines, lesser teachings, pardoned us and let us be, not trying to explain to us by saying, you will come to possess the insight of the thus come one, your portion of the stores of treasures. The Buddha didn't do that, right? The Buddha understood how they were clinging to unworthy desires and delighted in a lesser potential, a lesser aspiration, and recognized that in their minds and accepted that and let them be, let them, let that be their aspiration. And did not meet that with, well, wait a minute, no, there's more. Did not do that. And this is the Buddha's expedient means. And because we had considered this to be a great gain, that which they had realized, we had no wish to pursue the great vehicle, the Mahayana. In addition, though we expounded and set forth the Buddha wisdom for the sake of the Bodhisattva, so they were teaching, they were expounding the Dharma that they had realized for the benefit of those that they were teaching. But we ourselves did not aspire to attain. Because the Buddha knew that our minds delighted in these lesser teachings. And then he goes on to say, with regard to the Buddha wisdom, the world-honored one is never begrudging, is never resentful, doesn't hold that against them, doesn't see them as lesser in any way. Because from times past, we have in truth been the children of the Buddha, but we delighted in nothing but lesser doctrines, just like this prodigal child, like the children in the burning house parable. If we had had the kind of mind that delighted in great ones, then the Buddha would have taught us this Dharma. Now in this sutra, the Buddha expounds only the one vehicle. And in the past, when in the presence of the Bodhisattvas, he disparaged the voice hearers, in other words, their sort of aspiration, their realization, as those who delight in a lesser doctrine, the Buddha was in fact employing this great vehicle to teach and convert us. Therefore, we say that though originally we had no mind to covet or seek such a thing, now the great treasure of the Dharma King has come to us of its own accord. Kind of interesting, right? Not that they have made some willful effort to finally be able to hear this, but rather it's as though of its own accord now they do hear it. Okay, I wanted to just touch on one more part before, and then we'll look at questions. So, well, if you have the Watson book, I'm looking at page 92 in the verse section. But in this, in the verse section of this, he talks about, they reiterate this, but goes into a lot more detail about when it said before that they were really focusing on emptiness and non-form and non-action. They really flesh that out. And that's why it is good to read both the verse and the prose sections, because they're not exactly the same. And sometimes there's quite rich material, teachings in one that doesn't show up in the other in the same way. And so here they say, we sought to wipe out, now they're talking about their practice as disciples, as arhats, before they had been able to hear this teaching of the Bodhisattva path. We sought to wipe out what was within ourselves. That is all of our afflictions, all of our obstructions, all of our attachments. Believing that that was sufficient. We understood only this one concern and knew nothing of other matters. Though we might hear of purifying the Buddha lands and of teaching and converting living beings, we took no delight in such things. Why? Because all phenomena, and now they're speaking from their understanding, their previous understanding, because all phenomena are uniformly empty, tranquil, without birth, without extinction, without bigness, without smallness, without outflows, without action. And when one ponders in this way, one can feel no delight or joy. Through the long night, with regard to the Buddha wisdom, we were without greed, without attachment, without any desire to possess it. And we believed that with regard to the Dharma, we possessed the ultimate. Through that long night, we practiced the law of emptiness, gaining release from the threefold world, form, formlessness, and desire, and its burden of suffering and care. We dwelt in our final existence in the nirvana of remainder. Nirvana of remainder refers to in realizing emptiness of self and other, that there is no abiding self, that there is no birth and death of a self, of something that exists by itself on its own, that comes into being and that will pass out of existence. That in realizing that emptiness, the student, the person, is still occupying this body, which is the result of karma, right? So the karma that is carried within our consciousness at the time of death in the teachings of rebirth is what propels us forward because of the grasping at existence to seek another life. And so within the life of an enlightened being, they're living in what's called the nirvana of remainder. The remainder is this body, which is still carrying the karma, right, of past lives. And so it's not until passing that there is para-nirvana, ultimate nirvana, where there's finally complete release, because now there's no longer the karmic body that's being continued. And so they go on to say, through the teaching and conversion of the Buddha, we gained a way that was not vain. And that word that's used in different traditions almost always means self-centeredness. It means specifically self-clinging. It doesn't mean necessarily standing in the mirror and, you know, that kind of vanity, but just self-clinging. And in doing so, we repaid the debt we owed to the Buddha's kindness. And although for the sake of the Buddha's children, we preached the law of the Bodhisattva, urging them to seek the Buddha way, we ourselves never aspired to that teaching. We were thus abandoned by our guide and teacher because we had observed He had observed what was in our minds. And then goes on to reiterate some of what's already been said before. Okay, so let's pause there and see if there are any questions about or comments about what's happening here. And Gokhan will take questions from the assembly at home. Jackie, who's got the mics?
I'm just wondering, or rather asking for clarification on maybe expanding what does get transferred when someone goes through that process of rebirth. Because it says in the introduction that it isn't a soul per se, but what is it then, mm-hmm. you know, that gets transferred over mm-hmm. If it's not the soul, or is, you know, is the soul that sense of attachment to a thing, mm-hmm. you know, an entity then passing over. Mm-hmm. Is that what a soul means? Or, yeah, just wanting some clarification.
So when Buddhism speaks of soul and that it's not soul, that there is no soul, it's referring to any sense of any self-existing, permanent, ongoing entity-ness, selfness, quality or sort of seed or essence that is sort of the essence of you. And so when Buddhism, in the teachings that are reiterated over and over, that all things arise in every moment as a result of causes and conditions. The causes are karmic actions that are bringing forth this present moment. And then conditions are the internal conditions that include our ability to perceive it, so our sense organs, perceiving objects and consciousness. It can also be the conditions of state of mind, state of awareness, state of distraction. It can include the conditions of this time. In other words, everything that is necessary that is actually bringing this present experience into our consciousness. Okay, so everything is, the Buddha said all conditioned existence is dukkha, which is everything that we can experience, because everything that we can experience in our senses, in our mind, is a result of causes and conditions, which means it doesn't just exist on its own. It's a more sort of conceptual way of describing emptiness, that because nothing just exists, it has no inherent nature, right? It only is coming into being because of those causes and conditions. And that's exactly where we enter to practice. So when we try to clean up our house, we try to, you know, live a better life, we try to be more aware of how we use our mind, we follow the precepts, we practice atonement, all of these different practices that are taking responsibility for the karma that we're creating and have created, and trying to transform that, and so that we're creating less and less suffering and creating more and more virtue, basically, which all then feeds into our meditation, our ability to be mindful, to develop concentration, to gain insight, because we're not so preoccupied with putting out our fires, right? So consciousness, so everything is dependent upon conditions to come into being. So what are the conditions for consciousness? A previous moment of consciousness. So in order for this moment of consciousness to arise, it's dependent upon, the essential condition is that the previous moment of consciousness, which for those of you who study Yogacara teachings know that that was one of the sort of questions. Well, then what happens in samadhi where there is no consciousness? What happens in deep states of sleep where the mind is not aware? How then does it suddenly come back into consciousness if there wasn't a previous moment? And so the Yogacara teachings address that by talking about this alaya, this very deep, deepest level of consciousness, which is always present. So, but looking at it that way, from a Buddhist perspective, it's not possible that at birth we suddenly become conscious from nothing, that there is no pre-existing consciousness, because nothing in the universe exists without a condition. And so that condition is the previous moment of consciousness. And so from a Buddhist perspective of traditional teachings and rebirth, that goes all the way back into the infinite past. There is no beginning, because otherwise there would have to be a moment where there was no consciousness, and then suddenly, bing, it comes into being. And the Buddha said there is nothing in the universe that exists like that on its own. And so that's basically how sort of the teaching of rebirth and how it's understood. And so that consciousness is what continues. And it's not you, so it's not yourself, it's not your personality, but it does carry your karma. Because the Buddha also, Buddhism also teaches that it's not viable, that karma, it doesn't match our experience of things, that karma could just end with the end of a person's life. That that's just not viable, it's not tenable. And so that it has to continue. So how does it continue? It continues within our consciousness. So our consciousness is sort of imprinted, carrying the sort of karmic effects of our, not just this life, but all of our lives. And so that becomes extremely important in the Bodhisattva path, because each lifetime we have the opportunity to develop ourselves, right? Which means both to take responsibility for any past karma that is binding us or holding us back, and to enlighten that so that we are free. And that even if we're in very, very difficult circumstances that make that very challenging, then even if we just live the best life we can, then from within that understanding of rebirth, we will have ensured the best next lifetime that we can, because we are changing, we are not creating more negative karma, and we're sort of changing the karma that we have brought into this lifetime. So whether we believe in rebirth or not, from a Buddhist perspective, it makes all the sense in the world to live this life in the very best way we can. Because even if there's no rebirth, you get the best life possible. Right? That seems like a good idea. Okay. Brigitte? Gokhan, why don't you go ahead, and then we'll go to Brigitte.
This is from Michelle Sellers. Why do they say they cannot delight or joy, just turn me off. Why do they say they cannot feel delight or joy at realizing the truth of emptiness? Is it that they're self-centered and haven't seen the joy and vigor in helping others? In a Mahaprajnaparamita literature, it seems like realizing emptiness or interbeing is what brings joy and selflessness.
Yeah, so, you know, early Buddhism speaks about the afflictions, the karmic afflictions, the passions. And passions in that way don't mean to be passionate, but it'll be to, you know, be wholehearted about something. It means to be caught in our emotions, and which include both the high, you know, what we think of as all the positive emotions, as well as the negative emotions. Because all those positive emotions that we enjoy are impermanent, right? And so they tend to foster attachment. And so that when they pass, then we suffer again, right? And that sets up that whole cycle of attachment and samsara, because we go looking for more of that good feeling. And so equanimity, from an early Buddhist perspective, is really to be, it's not to be like, you know, a piece of wood, but it is to be stable, right? And not to be sort of, you know, lifted up by the highs and sent down by the lows, but to really be unattached. And so, and the other, I think, implicit within that, in the Vimalakirti Sutra, there's a, this question is asked very directly, how can someone who realizes emptiness have empathy? Why would they have compassion for anybody else, right? And Vimalakirti says, because they understand pain and suffering and what that is for another person who's experienced it, because they've experienced that themselves, and they've also freed themselves of it. And that motivates them to want to help in any way they can to help others to alleviate themselves. And so it doesn't lead to a kind of a lack of compassion or what it leads to in the Mahayana is that great aspiration to serve others, because to realize oneself and then just to live in that, in the enjoyment of that, from a Mahayana perspective, is self-centered, because it's not serving. It's not helping anyone. And that's not only stingy and greedy, but it's also sort of diluting the very thing that we've been enlightened to, which is that we all have one nature, right? And so that we are deluded together, we are enlightened together, we fall together, we rise together. And so to turn that enlightenment towards ourself as a kind of exclusive thing is considered. That's why there's so much, I mean, that's the heat within the sutra. That's what it's pointing at over and over and over again. Why do you think it emphasizes that so much? Why does it need to emphasize that so much? That it's not enough to just experience enlightenment oneself, but this, that's a lesser aspiration, that's a lesser path. Why is that so emphasized? And then we'll come back to you.
Because we get stuck there. Right. You know,
Why?
Because it's such a relief to be done with the like muck of your samsaric mind, like just like enough, like I don't want to deal with anybody else's. Yeah, that was really striking me actually in your retelling, not even so much when I was reading it personally, but when you were sort of bringing it to life this evening, just feeling like, wow, like that's what this teaching is about. And kind of taking that in and just feeling so touched by like the beauty of that.
And that rather than giving something up, you know, so putting others before oneself, you know, as I said before, my understanding of that is that the teachings understand you will put yourself in it, right? You will work towards your own liberation, the Buddha said, because you are most dear to yourself, right? And so in my mind, that's implicit. That's assumed that each of us is going to, in dedicating ourselves to serving others and to alleviating suffering of others, that we will want to do that for ourselves. We will also see that we must. We have to. Because we recognize that if we aren't doing that, then we're not actually able to help people as much as we could, right? Because we keep falling over ourselves. Mm-hmm. We keep stumbling into the ways in which we're not yet clear, because there's still false views or self-clinging. So there's, it's, so other, in order to fulfill that vow to serve others, they need us. They need you. We need you to be as clear as you can be. And so in that way, that's part of what is so beautiful about it, right? Because we could think of this as a great sacrifice. You know, everybody else gets to eat. You have to stand and serve, right? Everybody gets to eat. Brigitte?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about these, the disciples, Kashyapa and all the others, you know, they were so accomplished, but, you know, they were just not there completely. So, like, well, what about me then, you know? I'm not as accomplished as Kashyapa in the sutra, probably, before he had realized that, you know, the new teaching, you know, it almost sounds like it's a, you know, first this and then that. Mm-hmm. First realize this and then and then realize that. Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah.
Well, it's just that those who have the mic, right, in this sutra are the disciples, the early disciples of the Buddha, because the sutra is making this point, right? It wouldn't be the same point. They couldn't make that point if the Buddha was speaking to a host of bodhisattvas. They already know, right? They're already doing it. So there would be no sutra to teach. But the first part of what you said, you know, how, so what about you? Do you think if the Buddha was giving this teaching only for the sake of Shariputra and Subhuti and so on, then why are we reading it? Right? Why didn't he just have that? Why didn't they just have that conversation? Then it was over. Why was it? Why does it come down to us?
Yeah, and but then he's also saying maybe it's
no,
one
but
of
why.
Well, it's this.
Who's it for?
Yeah, well, it's for everyone, and but it seems like with the skillful means,
no,
says everything.
No, it's not for everyone. Who's it for?
For me.
And that's made very clear, right? Why else would it be? Right? The teachings are always for you, and that's part of what we are. Want to gain faith in. Yeah. Of course it's for everyone, but it is for you, right? Because in it being for everyone, you might exclude yourself. And so the sutra is here to say no, 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 no. Okay? Anyone else? Oh, Kyu-san.
Just kind of coming back to what Sean was saying too, like, I mean, it also seems that it's almost like, I mean, I know the context of this was like, you know, a couple hundred years after, you know, this kind of the old kind of practice ways, and it seems, I mean, it kind of makes it seem like that's a bit of a drag, right? And they're,
what's a drag?
That way of practicing.
Oh. Mm.
Because they emphasize that, like, there's no delight or joy in that. And I think it's like almost like being attached to being non-attached or something. Mm. And so, you know, I think there's a little bit of a more like celebratory, it feels like a, you know, you were saying like bringing this alive. It's like, it's like bringing it more alive.
Yeah.
And in there, I really get that in this. And it's, you know, but they also say, like, well, if we didn't do this, then we wouldn't be able to hear it, too. It's because we've followed the precepts and we've done this.
And remember that all of that, this, is within the context of what the Buddha's established at the very beginning, that there's only one vehicle.
Yeah.
So what he's saying is, you are, basically, you are a bodhisattva. You just didn't know it, right? You are actually on this path. You just didn't know it yet.
Uh-huh.
Now you know it. Because you're ready to hear that. But let's be, you know, let's just remember that this is a Mahayana Sutra, which is making a number of points, and it's using the early tradition as a vehicle to do that. And so when you're talking to a Theravada practitioner, you know, that you don't accuse them of having no joy and...
Yes, no, I'm aware of that. The other thing I was thinking too is that, you know, I've been listening to it, and and you can, you know, like kind of what you were saying in the very beginning, I don't know if anybody, you know, it's on Audible or whatever, but you can hear it, and it feels very different than reading it. And you can hear why it's repeated, because you can memorize it better. You know, hearing it and then hearing it in verse, and you can hear the differences in it. And like, you know, reading it, I might be like, okay, I'm going to fast forward through this a little bit. And if you don't, you just like are listening and taking it in a different way.
I didn't know that it was...
It's a little different translation, but it's pretty much the same. They says the rich merchant has slaves in that one. This one they don't. But this one is like the, you know, it's a little bit different, but it's pretty much the same. But you can hear the why. You know, it doesn't take that long. Like that, that's like 30 minutes of talking. Is that chapter? So just to put it in context, it's like less than a Dharma talk.
And a lot more. See, that's what the wiser you get, you can say a lot more in a lot less time. Well, I was just thinking of Chikan and some of the other sanghas, students who are getting together regularly to read it, you know, that practice. Okay, let's take a stretch break for about 5 minutes, and we'll come back and go in, because the next chapter has this parable, which is quite nice. So 5 minutes, folks at home. So this next chapter is the parable of the medicinal herbs. So the Buddha begins speaking to Mahakasyapa, and he says, "Kasyapa, you should understand this, that thus come one is king of the doctrines." Now also, there's a lot in this sutra where the Buddha is presenting himself with all kinds of, you know, great adjectives. And so remember, this is the Mahayana Sutra putting words into the mouth of the Buddha. Okay. In what he preaches, there's nothing that is vain. There's nothing that is self-centered or self-clinging. He employs wisdom as an expedient means in expounding them. Therefore, the doctrines that he expounds all extend to the point where there is comprehensive wisdom. They extend to that point. They bring us to that point. He also understands the workings of the deepest mind of all living beings, penetrating them completely and without hindrance. And so he says, "Kasyapa, it's like the plants and trees, thickets and groves, and the medicinal herbs, widely ranging in variety, each with its own name and hue, that grows in the hills and streams, the valleys, and different soils of the thousand millionfold world. Dense clouds spread over them, covering the entire thousand millionfold world, and in one moment, saturating it all. The moisture penetrates to all the plants and trees, thickets and groves, and medicinal herbs equally, to their little roots, little stems, little limbs, little leaves, their middle-sized roots, middle-sized stems, limbs, leaves, to their big roots, big stems, big limbs, big leaves. Each of the trees, big and small, depending upon whether it is superior, middling, or inferior in nature, receives its allotment. The rain falling from one blanket of cloud accords with each particular species and nature, causing it to sprout and mature, to blossom and bear fruit. Though all these plants and trees grow in the same earth and are moistened by the same rain, each has its differences and particulars." And then he says, "You should understand that the thus come one is just like this, appearing as a great cloud with a loud voice. A lion's roar penetrates to all heavenly and human beings. Those who have not yet crossed over, I will cause to cross over. I was not yet freed, I will free. I was not yet at rest, I will put at rest. Those not yet in nirvana will cause to attain nirvana. The thus come one observes whether the capacities of these living beings are keen or dull, whether they are diligent in their efforts or lazy. And in accordance with what each is capable of hearing, he preaches the Dharma for them in an immeasurable variety of ways, so that all of them are delighted and all are able to gain excellent benefits therefrom. Once having heard the Dharma, they will enjoy peace and security in their present existence, good circumstances in their future existence. Having heard the law, they will escape from obstacles and hindrances. They will be able to exercise their powers, their spiritual powers, to the fullest, so they can gradually enter into the way. Like the rain falling from that great cloud upon every plant and tree, thickened a grove, and all medicinal herbs. Each receives its full share of moistening and is enabled to sprout and grow. And then he says that this Dharma preached by the Thus Come One is of one form, one flavor, namely the form of emancipation, the form of separation, that is, being liberated from delusion, the form of extinction, which in the end comes down to a wisdom embracing all species. When the living beings hear this Dharma, though they may embrace, read, and recite it, and practice it as it dictates, they themselves do not realize or understand the blessings they are gaining thereby. Why? Because the Thus Come One understands the species, the form, the substance, the nature of these living beings. He knows what things they dwell on, what things they ponder, what things they practice. He knows how they dwell on them, how they ponder, how they practice. He knows what dharma they dwell on and what dharma they ponder, what dharma they practice, through what dharma they attain, what dharma. Living beings exist in a variety of environments, but only the Buddha sees the true circumstances and fully understands them without hindrances. Because of the desires that are in the minds of living beings, he guides and protects them, and for this reason does not immediately preach to them the wisdom that embraces all species. In other words, doesn't just offer one teaching, right, that everyone hears, but rather, like the rain, right, it's the same rain, same nature, same water, but everywhere it falls in perfect accord with the plant that needs it. I need to get the mic.
Shugan, but there are some places where the rain doesn't fall. You know, in our world, in these end of times, where there's so much suffering, so much, you know, conditions are not right for everyone to hear the Dharma at all. So it's not quite so that every plant gets its full share of moisture or nourishment.
Okay.
All right. I have another question. That is, the Buddha...
I mean, one way of looking at that is that, whether it's that wherever the rain is falling.
Yeah.
Right. That it's falling. Because he's not, I don't hear him saying he's teaching everywhere to everyone at the same time. Right.
Okay. Then there's a couple of sentences there where he repeats how he causes people to come to enlightenment, to understanding, yeah. And he causes them to see their true nature, and he causes them to do this and that and the other thing.
Yeah, what about that?
And that sort of stuck for me because we have to do it. I've always understood that we need to practice and realize it for ourselves. He's not a savior. He's not going to do it for us. He's not giving us anything. We need to practice and realize it for ourselves.
And so that is true. And so knowing that, how do you hear this?
I'm not sure. I understand exactly what he intended when he formed those words. Maybe when he says he causes beings to come to enlightenment, he meant in a kind of cosmic sense. I don't know.
Well, when you say you have to do it yourself.
Yeah.
But what needs to happen in order for you to do it yourself?
I need to hear the Dharma. Yeah. But that's not a sufficient cause. It's a...
We need to hear the Dharma. We need to, if we're fortunate enough, we need to study with a teacher. We need to do the work that only we can do.
Yeah.
But we don't just do it ourselves. We don't.
Yeah, and at the same time, though, we're not all Huineng, you know. We don't, we're not sort of switched on by a line from a sutra.
We're not what?
We're not all Huineng. You know, we're not, at just hearing the line from a sutra immediately opened up.
Right. Well, yeah. That's, you know, when he talks about it, and, you know, you come across this in the teachings a lot about people of different capacities. And, you know, I think that, remember that there's no intrinsic qualities. You know, it's not that some people are intrinsically, you know, middling, superior, inferior. We can look at that in terms of, you know, the karma that we have created, or that we've, you know, the lives we've experienced, and, you know, how fortunate or what the circumstances are and how much they might have helped us. We can look at it in terms of our own, I mean, you can look at it in terms of genetics, you can look at it in terms of life circumstances, you can look at that in terms of how we have actually used our life, you know. So some people come to the Dharma and in a sense began a long time ago before they encountered the teachings. And some people come sort of straight up the elevator from hell, you know, like they just got off.
Yeah.
And they're fresh in, they're still on fire.
Yeah.
Right? So there's nothing about, you know, an intrinsic value or worth, but in terms of, and there's also no predictor necessarily about how two different people are going to unfold. Sometimes people with a lot of, you know, benefit get lazy, you know, when things are easy. And so, but just in terms of how do we read that, you know, the Buddha observes whether the capacity of these living beings are keen or dull. Well, we can be both. Whether we're diligent or lazy, we can be both, right? We may have a disposition towards one or the other. We may sort of be inclined towards being lazy or being inclined towards being diligent, right? For various reasons, you know. And we can also develop qualities that may not be very strong yet. We can also let dissipate and fall away qualities we have learned that aren't very helpful. And so, but I think the point is that it's, that the teachings, that there's one teaching, right? There's one flavor, and that's the flavor of emancipation. But that, that teaching is presented in a multitude of ways. Why? To be expedient, to actually be heard by the person who is listening. Because if it's not heard by the person that is listening, then it doesn't exist for them. It's not living for them, right? It's not expedient. And what allows each of us to hear it, and the way we hear it, and how deeply we hear it, is, you know, part of those, you know, what we bring into practice is part of what we've done in our lives, is part of, you know, all kinds of aspects. But I think the point is just to recognize that there is a universal aspect to this, right? That it falls equally everywhere, and that it falls in accord with the plant, the life force that needs it. Though all these plants and trees grow in the same earth and are moistened by the same rain, each has its differences and particulars, right? Which are really, really important. That's why face-to-face teaching is so important. You know, that in a, like here, you know, like I am saying certain things that each of you are hearing, I don't know what, actually. I don't know what. And so in face-to-face teaching, the teacher has an opportunity to hear what the student is hearing, to see what the student is seeing, right? And not only what they're hearing, but what are they, how are they understanding it, and how are they bringing that into their practice, right? Which is extremely important.
Could it be that rain doesn't look the same for everything and everybody? So for one person, one plant, the Lotus Sutra might be perfect, or another person hears a bird song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so, and you just look at different aspects of the teachings, different practices, that, you know, it's the main reason we ask that what happens in face-to-face teaching is not talked about, is because it isn't for anyone else. It's just for that person. It's just for that student, and just for that student in that moment. It may not be the same in another moment. And when it gets taken outside, it gets kind of stamped, you know, with a kind of fixedness. It's not helpful. So I remember, you know, my name Shugen means rigorous practice. And so when Dada Roshi first gave me that name, you know, he would sort of talk about that. And I remember going into Dokusan, you know, many years later, and he went on this whole thing about how Shugen means gentle, soft practice. And I was like, really? Yeah. And it was true for me at that time. That was rigorous. That required rigor for me to trust that. Let me just see. Gokhan, anyone at home?
This is Caleb. In this parable, I also hear the need to only take for ourselves what is necessary. I'm reminded of invasive plants who are only doing what they do, but who by thriving make it harder for others to do the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's actually sort of extending that parable in terms of what we you know, scientists, biologists, botanists know more and more, is that how, you know, all of these plants are feeding each other. You know, so in that way they're receiving the rain and then they're offering it up to others. But basically you're not hoarding. Was that the point? You're just taking what you need?
I'm not sure that is the point. It's by thriving, they're making it harder for others to do the same.
By what?
By thriving.
Oh, I see. Well, let's remember it's a parable. Okay, so any parable, metaphor, analogy is going to be imperfect. So on page 99, I want to see what you thought about this, where he says, when the living beings hear the Dharma, they may embrace it, read it, recite it, practice it. Though they themselves do not realize or understand the blessings they are gaining, Why? What do you think he's saying there? They're doing what the Buddha's asking them. They're embracing it, they're reading, they're reciting, they're putting it into practice according to the teachings. But he says, but they themselves do not realize or understand the blessings that they are gaining thereby. What do you think he means by that? For you?
That no one completely understands or realizes or attains, you know, completely deeply at first. It takes time.
Mm-hmm. And that being so, well, let me just see if anybody else wants to comment on that. Laura?
It's reminding me of the line back in the previous sutra on page 87. This cluster of unsurpassed jewels has come to us unsought. That there's something about the effort required to practice mm-hmm. diligently, mm-hmm. and yet not grasping for something mm-hmm. out of that. In a way, or the effort being effortless mm-hmm. at some point, mm-hmm. so they say. But that just like pulls me back to that idea. Like, can we fully understand all that is mm-hmm. occurring? Because there's a dimension that's beyond the effort.
Mm-hmm. And so if you receive something, if I receive something and I don't fully understand it, how am I likely to receive that? I mean,
to the degree that you can.
To the degree that I can. And so in terms of my both understanding of it, perhaps my appreciation of it, my sense of its possibility, of what it's actually the potential that it might have for me. That's how I hear this, that we don't fully understand or realize the blessings that we are gaining. You know, we hear these teachings, like we receive instructions in Zazen, and it's like, okay, I get it. You know, I turn my leg, hands, you know, eyes, you know, breath, count, let go, all right. You know, and it's like, We don't and really can't, and it's not because we're doing something wrong, that we can't really appreciate or know the gift we have just been given, the blessings that we have just been offered. And we may never, right? I may not continue, right? I may think, you know, this isn't really working for me, and maybe it's not. But you know, when I think about my own, I was thinking about yesterday morning when I went up and did a service at the stupa for Dadaroshi, and I was doing liturgy, and I was just thinking about, him as my teacher and me as his student. And there have been so many times where it's like, I wish I could do that again, because I would do it better. I would be a better student. In terms of, and in direct relationship to this, that I, because I was caught in myself and struggling with that, that there were so many times where I didn't fully see what I was receiving from him. And even when I did, I knew that he was giving, and of course I did know that a lot. You know, it was only with time that I was able to look back on that and think, oh. I think it's a natural thing, but it's, yeah. I think it's part of the, you know, it's why I just hope people will stick around long enough to begin to experience some of those deeper treasures that comes out of understanding. But it's not just about insight. that it really goes hand in hand with our own unfolding, you know, that really allows us to be where we are, to know where we are, to know what we're in the midst of, and not just in terms of teachings or training or dharma, but in terms of the whole thing. You know, it's like, why can gratitude be difficult? You know, why sometimes it's hard to feel grateful? You know, for me, it's always been in times where it's like, I wasn't aware that I was really receiving something. You know, and intellectually, I could say, well, you know, I've got food and shelter and, you know, those things. But it's abstract. It wasn't really knowing. I think that's part of, you know, what Sangha and what training and all of this is about, is to sort of hold us, hold this self as it goes through its paces and tantrums and, you know, highs and lows, and just holds it, right? So that we can keep going, and so that that can begin to open up. Anybody else? I want to leave some room for the last chapter, but a couple more points here. Oh, in the Watson translation on page 103, there's a nice section where I feel like the Buddha is just sort of presenting kind of an aspiration, you know, speaking from the Buddha's own perspective, his enlightened view. I look upon all things as being universally equal. I have no mind to favor this or that, to love one or hate another. I am without greed or attachment, without limitation or hindrance. At all times, for all things, I teach the Dharma equally as I would for a single person. That same way I do for numerous persons. Constantly I expound and teach the Dharma. Never have I done anything else. Coming, going, sitting, standing. Never to the end growing weary or disheartened. I bring fullness and satisfaction to the world like a rain that spreads its moisture everywhere. Eminent and lowly, superior and inferior, observers of precepts, violators of precepts, those fully endowed with proper demeanor, those not fully endowed, those of correct views, of erroneous views, of keen capacity, of dull capacity. I cause the Dharma rain to rain on all equally, never lax or neglectful. When all the various living beings hear my teaching, they receive it according to their power, dwelling in their different environments. Some inhabit the realm of human and heavenly beings, of wheel-turning sage, king, chakra, Brahma, and the other kings. These are the inferior medicinal herbs. Some understand the law of no outflow. So these would be, as I understand, just people of the world inhabiting the world of samsara, even though they may be living good lives. Some understand the law of no outflows, are able to attain nirvana, acquire the six transcendental powers, and so on. Live alone in mountain forests, constantly practicing meditation, gaining the enlightenment of the Pratyeka Buddhas. These are the disciples. These are the middling medicinal herbs. Still others seek the place of the world-honored one, convinced that they can become Buddhas. He's talking to you. That they can become Buddhas, putting forth diligent effort and practicing meditation. These are the superior medicinal herbs. And what's interesting is that there's nothing intrinsic about the person that is low, middling, or high. It has nothing to do with the person themselves. It has to do with their aspiration, right? Of how they are living their life. And not because that makes them more of a person, a better person, intrinsically, but because it brings them into a place of Buddhahood and Bodhisattvahood, of making their lives of service, of being a benefit. And I just thought that was such a nice presentation of the impartiality of the Buddha. And you think about the Buddha, you know, think about Devadatta, think about Angulimala, think about the headaches. Well, maybe he didn't get headaches, but the challenges he was presented with. There's a sutra where he hears about a community of his that are being really sloppy and rude and kind of disheveled, and it's breaking down that kind of sacred trust between them, the Buddha Sangha, and the community. And so he goes to them and says, look, you guys have to like clean up your act. This is not working. There's another sutra where there's a group of disciples who decide that they want to have supper. Right? They want to eat afternoon. And they've got very logical arguments for why that's a good idea. And the Buddha's like, no. No, that's not a good idea. That's not the way we do things. And my memory of that sutra is they were like, well, you know, we're just going to do it. So what's he going to do, right? Throw them in jail? And so I think about him, and that doesn't mean he was passive. You know, impartiality doesn't mean you just, you know, don't give a shit and just let anybody do whatever they want. It means he was trying to show, to bring, to rain down, right? A rain that would be nourishing, but it wasn't always received. You know, that he was known for that in his time, for admitting people from all different levels of society at a time where there were very clear levels. It wasn't, you know, the caste system was not as I understand it, was not as solidified as it came to be, but it was there. And there were lines that were generally not crossed. There were associations that were culturally, socially not had, and he did not abide by those. And that's coming directly out of his enlightenment. I look upon all things as being universally equal. That is, I have realized all things, all beings, as being equal, as having the same nature. And that I have no mind to favor, to love one, hate another, to have greed or attachment, or to be offended by love and hate, greed or attachment in another, because he understands, right? He understands all of those forces that exist within us because he has had to go through that himself. And so he sees them as a result of cause and condition. He doesn't see it as, this is who you are. There's nothing to be done about it. He sees a suffering person who is subject under the control or under the weight of their karma, right? So I thought that was very nice. Mm-hmm. Cheerio.
I guess I always get a little like, I'm not sure what the word is for how I feel about it, but you know, when I hear this language that's seems to be establishing hierarchies and values, you know, like, and I just find it kind of confusing. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, like, I understand it's to whatever capacity they're one that one has, and that's clear, but it's sort of like superior, mm-hmm. middling, mm-hmm. inferior. It's pretty intense language. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the beginning when he first starts talking about it, and he says, like according to their natures, and the use, maybe it's just a translation thing, but it's sort of like that word always feels very intrinsic.
Yeah.
You know, like your nature is inferior, your nature is middling, your nature is superior. And so then that question always comes up, like, what's mine?
You know? Right, and naturally so, I mean, we're always going to try and locate ourselves, right?
Can I change it?
In that kind of language, right? And so some of us might rush right to the top. Some of us might rush to the bottom. Some of us might just stand not knowing. Some of us might reject it altogether. I don't want any part of this. Yeah. And so I agree. It's potent. And so would that there are ways to speak of that and sort of communicate the essence of what's trying to be communicated without it being solidified, you know, into who a person is. That's why I'm sort of making a point of trying to make that clear. And so I think we just have to keep remembering and keep remembering that. You know, it's sort of like doing an internal translation of what is really being communicated there. And that, you know, it's kind of like I was saying a moment ago, we might think of ourselves or think of somebody else as, I mean, I remember being here in the very early years. I mean, I was probably my first year. And there was somebody who was here, had been here before me, was, you know, an older guy, had good experience in their life, was pretty worldly, smart, intelligent, very capable. And I could see, I didn't know much at all, but I could see that this person was being groomed. That there was sort of a hope or an intention that this person had a real capacity. I don't remember how long they stayed, but it wasn't a long time. And whether it was because they were being groomed, and that just was not good skill. But, you know, it's sort of that whole idea of how we assess and, you know, our biases, how we sort of look at people and decide and think we know. We don't. I really don't. And so how do we speak about the fact that, you know, without any intrinsic nature, that we do come in, you know, I mean, it's hard to even say that. That I have not yet said, because I was going to say, you know, based on the lives we led, the way, what we've done in our life, have we ever done any self-reflection? Have we, you know, are we really just, is this like just completely different from anything we've ever done? And has our life sort of been conducive for leading us to this? Or do we have like a bundle of karma, of fires burning behind us that we're going to have to deal with, like Milarepa. So Milarepa is a perfect example, right, of this person with great capacity who had a tremendous, an unimaginable karmic burden, right? And so that required a momentous effort, right, on the part of his teacher. And so that's the way I think of it, is just that we don't actually know when we come into training what our capacity is or what our challenges are going to be. I mean, we might think we do, or how it's going to go. We really don't know any of that. And neither does the teacher. You know, we may think we know, the teacher may think they know, but they will be surprised, right? All over the place. And so I think holding it in that spirit and just thinking about, like, what is the purpose of this? The purpose of this is to rain down on us, right, and nourish our roots. And so how can we hear it in such ways that it can do that? So let's look at this last chapter, which I was just going to take a couple of minutes with. And really, because it's a... there's a theme here. So the Buddha, the very first paragraph, he predicts that Mahakashyapa, in a future existence, in future existences, will be able to enter the presence of 3,000 billion Buddhas, offer alms, pay reverence, honor and praise him, and will eventually, in his last life, in his last rebirth, will be able to become a Buddha named Light Bright, thus come one. So he's saying that this Mahakashyapa is going to become a completely enlightened being, not just realized like the arhats, but a completely enlightened, will be the Buddha of his time. And then he goes on to make other predictions, right? Sabuti and Katyayana and Madhyayana. So these are all some of the very prominent disciples of the Buddha. And this is just the beginning, right, as the Buddha goes on. And again, think about that. Like, what is being communicated here? You know, if he had just said, out of all of you, Kaishapa, I predict, and that's it, right? That would have communicated something quite different. Right? And so one question is, what do you make of that? What is, because this is such an important, prominent part of the sutra, all of these predictions. And I just wanted to bring our attention to one passage that I thought was quite interesting, when he is talking about the realm in which Kaishapa will be a fully enlightened being. It will be majestically adorned, free of defilement or evil, shards or rubble, thorns or briars, or the unclean refuse of latrines. So who knows where that goes? It will be level and smooth. It's going to be a very nice place. And then he says, there will be no workings of the devil here, although the devil and the devil's people will be there. They will all protect the Dharma of the Buddha. Everybody's there. They're devils. They're just not doing devil work. So what do you make of these prophecies? Right? Again, think of this just as it's a sutra. It's a teaching. As you take that in, if you like, what does that offer to you? Let's see if there's anybody. I see we'll come back to you. Let's see if there's anybody else. And this is a, you know, part of this is a practice of stepping forward, speaking, asking a question. Scott?
The way that lands with me is that he may have selected those individuals, but he could have selected any of them, since they, if they all had Buddha nature, then they all could become that eventually, given enough action. So that's how that lands with me.
And so if you think of that in terms of what does that say about you, what does that say about us?
Given enough turns of the wheel of time, that we all can get to that point if we just continue the path and the way.
That we are on a path, that Buddhism sees it as that we are on a path moving towards our deepest desire, which is to be free. And that it's a long path from the Mahayana perspective, because we have such propensities, right, to get for attachments. And I mean, if you think about it, to just respond to our desires, to not just respond to our desires, is a pretty like radical thing, you know, because when you respond to your desire, you get something right now, right? It's immediate. You get a positive response to that. And so to see that and see that possibility and go another way is kind of strange, right?
Can you explain a little more the line about the devils? I don't think I quite followed that.
Well, what do you think he's saying? So there will be no workings of the devil, although they and their people will be there. They will be protecting the Dharma of the Buddha. So what's happening there?
The devils will be protecting the Dharma of the Buddha? That's what he's saying?
That's what he's saying.
I'm not quite sure.
Well, I mean, if you just sort of say what it's actually saying. So what are the devils about in this world? What's their daily work? How is it different than it used to be?
In this instance, they're going to be protecting the law of the Buddha.
Yeah, and what were they doing before?
All bunch of shenanigans.
Exactly, causing a whole bunch of trouble, a whole heap of trouble. They're there, so no one's been excluded.
Okay.
But because they're there because they're no longer doing the work of the devil. They did not need to change who they were. So whether we call them a devil, whether we call them something else, doesn't really matter. But to call them a devil makes it helps to make it clear that they didn't actually need to change who they were. Right? We don't have to become someone else. They didn't have to become saints. Being a devil is fine. There's room for the devil. You just need to deal with your devilry ways.
Well, can I think this follows up. This is from Dyson. To me, it means that this now is Buddha nature. The demons now are Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are now on the path, basically.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is this all, this whole fantastical description all in the realized person's mind? That's like how they see and experience, so to speak. It says, you know, somewhere
descriptions of these realms.
Yeah, and because it says everywhere will be pure and clean, and all who see it will rejoice. So it seems like it's not a different world, but almost like a different dimension.
Yeah.
You know, some can see it and some cannot see it.
Yeah.
This can happen. This Buddha is appearing. Not everyone sees it.
Yeah.
Those who do rejoice.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's a passage also in the Vimalakirti Sutra where, I don't remember who the person is, let's say it's Shariputra, who the Buddha is talking about this world in this way. And Shariputra is looking around and thinking, what are you talking about? You know, I see, you know, lots of, you know, unclean latrines and, you know, lots of shards and rubble. And somebody who's standing there sees the mind of Shariputra and says, those highs and lows that you see are in your mind. Right? In other words, we're all standing here in the same world, but we're seeing that world differently. Now, you know, when we think about this world and what we see, it's hard to imagine how could we look at many things in this world as is described here. So it is a metaphor, right? It is poetry. It is as inspirational as aspirational. It's not to be understood literally. But it is talking about the power of the mind. The Buddha said the world is your sense consciousnesses, right? And so how we see is dependent upon, right? What were the conditions of seeing itself? So, you know, it's that, you know, Watson talks about how that language, which is so grand, is to shake us loose a little bit, you know, from sort of our sort of more material clenching at things being just the way we see them in this moment with this mind. It was with that mind that I thought Kyusan said that the entire sutra was only took 30 minutes to read. See, I was hearing it from that place where anything is possible. And it would sound exactly at the right tempo, and you would hear every word. Okay, so I think we'll finish up. So 2 weeks from today, we'll meet again, and we'll just go into the next couple chapters. There's another really nice parable, The Phantom City. I've always really liked that one. And then more prophecies, okay? So we'll concentrate on those. And kind of, you know, as you're going through and studying this, look for, you know, just see what jumps out for you, you know, because of some of these lines that I've been pulling out, just see if they're, you know, phrases or lines that really leap out to you and seem to have power or raise questions. There are a lot of real gems in here. I mean, it's really, I've been really enjoying this. And just reading it. You know, what I basically do between now and time is I just, each day I read some, and because we're only doing a few chapters, and then I just go back and start again, and just reading very slowly, taking it in. All right. Can you chant us out?